From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in March of 2010, just one day before President Barack Obama was set to sign the Affordable Care Act into law. The New York Times reports that a group of Republicans met in Senator Mitch McConnell's office. They were in search of a way to mobilize public opposition to the ACA. And they were talking about the need to repeal the new law as soon as possible. And that's when Josh Holmes, a communications advisor to Senator McConnell, tried out a new phrase. How about not just repeal, he asked. How about repeal and replace? Well, the phrase that was born that day has become the battle cry against the Affordable Care Act for nearly 7 years. And yet on the eve of Donald Trump's inauguration, there is still no clear picture for what the replacement will look like. The repeal is almost certainly going to happen. It could happen pretty quickly. Regarding the whole replace thing, Donald Trump said a few days ago that his plan is to cover all Americans at a lower cost. Let's just stipulate that this is almost certainly impossible and a massive overpromise. And so what then? Well, this hour, a conversation about the unanswered questions still hanging in the air. Maybe you're one of the small business owners who contacted us after the election to say you look forward to getting rid of the ACA. Maybe you're concerned about losing insurance for you and your family. Maybe you're concerned about pre-existing conditions or your kids' health care. Let's talk about it. We do not have all the answers. That's not the framework here. We're going to try to at least enumerate the questions and tell you what we do know. And helping lead the discussion this hour is my distinguished colleague, Karen Chakurji, who's a health reporter and producer for WXXI News. And Karen's been selected to be part of the NPR Kaiser Health reporting collaboration, which means she's going to be doing in-depth reporting on the subject throughout the year. It's great to have you in studio. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also here is Dr. David Topa. He's a pediatrician at Pittsford Pediatric Associates. Dr. Topa, welcome to you.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Brendan O'Connor is here, a primary care physician at Unity Family Medicine at Chilai Center. Dr. O'Connor, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Andrew Groutman's here. Andy is an archaeologist who is concerned about what repeal and replace may mean for him. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with you, Andy, because you reached out just to mention that you're like probably millions of people who have all kinds of questions. And again, we don't have the answers, but I think your story illustrates where a good number of Americans are right now. Your healthcare situation wasn't really stabilized until the ACA, is that right?
No, it was not.
All right, so tell me a little bit about kind of that movement for you and your career and what happened with that.
Well, a little bit of background. I studied at Boston University, become an archaeologist, and was fortunate enough to come back to Rochester where I grew up, and for almost a decade worked at the Rochester Museum and Science Center until they closed their program in 2012. And while I was with the museum, they provided health insurance. I was matching some of it. The museum was paying for a little bit more of it. But my entire family had health insurance through the museum. Once the program was shut down, I was able to continue a little bit of coverage through the COBRA program, and then that rolled into other programs, which ended up becoming just incredibly expensive. Luckily, in New York State, pretty much every child is covered, so my kids have never had a problem, but it got to the point where health insurance was just too expensive for my wife and myself, and we didn't have health insurance for quite a while until the Affordable Care Act came through.
Okay, and how has it been for you under the ACA?
Honestly, pretty fantastic. I've had nothing but a good experience with it. I was told, I actually went through a broker, which she put me through the whole system and show me different plans, told me about the subsidies, and because of that, I now have health insurance.
And your biggest question going forward then is what?
If it's going to be affordable. You know, they say that there's going to be a repeal and replace. Obviously, the repeal is going to come through, but what are they going to be replacing it with? And is that going to be affordable to just an average person like myself?
All right. So if it goes back to, if the replace is something much more like what we saw pre-ACA, your cost will be much higher.
Oh, yeah, probably tenfold.
Okay. I should let our listeners know, a conservative friend of mine warned me, you're not going to have a battle of anecdotes, are you? That's not journalism. And I said, look, here's how I feel about having conversations about, you know, sort of complex issues that have a lot of data behind them. I think anecdotes are helpful when they illustrate what is not an outlier situation. I don't think Andy is an outlier. It doesn't mean that everybody feels the same way, and it doesn't mean it's the exact same situation for him. So as I open up the phone lines, We can talk this hour about either your concerns, your optimism, the questions you have going forward. And as I said at the start of the hour, we heard from small business owners in particular after the election who said that this will be good for them. Absolutely. We're open to your experience with that. But there's a lot of people like Andy as well. You can call the program toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Karen Chakurji, in your own reporting, we're going to be talking about some of the great work you've already done in recent months on this. But Andy's story, I say, isn't an outlier because there's, I think I read one of your reports, almost 3 million people on the exchanges in this state alone, right?
That's right. Yep.
And so we're talking about a lot of people who have unanswered questions, maybe not all in the exact same situation, but you know, for you as a reporter, what are you hearing from people about the questions they have?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, although the particulars might change from person to person in terms of family members and their kind of, you know, last time they had a job or where they're going and all of that, I think for the most part, the narrative of, you know, the ACA hooked me up with health insurance in a way that I didn't quite have it before is something that I have heard, you know, quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah. And so, and Dr. Topa is a pediatrician at Pittsburgh Pediatric Associates, who you kind of come at this, interestingly enough, from a personal point of view and also as a doctor looking at patients, don't you?
Yeah, I kind of come at this from about three points of view, I have to say. Personally, I'm self-employed. So when it comes to shopping for insurance, my wife does not get through her job. And so I'm basically on the marketplace, even though I don't qualify for any of the subsidies. And interestingly enough, I've had a high deductible plan for about 5 years now. And the very first year that we had the plan, I hadn't had a chance to start to put any money into the health savings account that can go along with it. That's a pile of money you could put away tax-free to help pay for co-pays and your deductible. And we had a high deductible plan. And in March, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. Otherwise healthy, no pre-existing conditions. And I kind of got my real quick education in how the insurance, I guess, industry or how the healthcare system works from the perspective of a patient, of someone who's actually incurring high costs. And so in that point, I learned real quick what deductibles mean, how hard it is to price shop, how opaque the whole system is. And then I'm also a business owner, so we do offer some limited coverage options to some of our employees who choose to take it. We also, and then I'm a pediatrician, and so we are on the payment side of the whole system as well. And things that the ACA provides that are more concerning to me, not just the financial side of it, but also the access side. We're talking about how long can kids stay on their parents' insurance. For us as a pediatrician, I'll see people through age 22, 23 at the highest. And so as a provider and business owner, if I lose that stream of patients coming into the office, it changes how we have to practice and also changes what kind of services I can provide to them and keep them healthy.
And Dr. Topa, there's no question that had the ACA stayed in place, we're assuming it's going to be repealed, but had it stayed in place, you know, a number of years in, there's a need to look at the landscape and say, what could it have done better or more efficiently or done to help with costs? You know, were the carrots and sticks big enough? Were they working well enough? Had the ACA stuck around, what was your biggest complaint with it?
I guess if you talk to any group of physicians, change is hard. And so yeah. What the ACA really did, I mean, it looked at, though, it's, I perceive as not being a system of health insurance, but also wellness, meaning, okay, the government's basically trying to get the system working in a way that's better, where we get better outcomes. And so as a physician, I get paid on a per-visit basis right now, and that's how it's been historically. And if I wanted to make more money, it wasn't because I would provide better care. Mm-hmm. I'd have to pile more people through my office. And so the ACA really kind of looked at that, and part of it looked at setting up payment for performance measures, which, again, the physician community held as a whole in terms of sitting there saying, oh, you can't do this to us. And Dr. Lou Papa's been on the show before, and I just had a talk the other night where he said physicians are kind of like sharks, where you know, we tend not to change because evolution has made us perfect, and so why would we? And so I'll gladly give that one to Lou, but we're a really hard group to adopt change. But as we're going through, they put out, the ACA is responsible for putting out measures of whether it's blood pressures, immunization rates, that as physicians we now have to start to work towards to basically make up part of our reimbursement here.
Yeah, Dr. Atul Gawande was, you might have heard him in an interview with Robert Siegel on All Things Considered this week. He wrote a piece for The New Yorker about preventive care or incremental care as opposed to, you know, a system that pays a lot of money for catastrophic care.
Right.
And the concern is, are we going back to a system that's more in that way?
Exactly. And so I guess getting back to your original question, would it really have a huge impact on me if the Affordable Care Act kept going forward as is? I mean, hard to tell. I mean, costs are rising, and in the pediatric community, it's different than in the hospitals or in the independent practice community, it's different. But I think we've adjusted to the new normal, and so amongst myself and my partners, I mean, I don't think we've had a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth. We're kind of dragging. You know, we're not, like I said, change is hard. And so we're getting used to meeting the measures, submitting information that we never had to submit before. But also, you pick up room for improvement as well. And
well, let me ask Dr. Brennan O'Connor then to share his thoughts. He's a primary care physician at Unity Family Medicine at Tri-Life Center. And for you, you know, what are the unanswered questions? Is it more for you? Is it more for the people you're treating?
It's more for the people I'm treating. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can say from my experience that Andy is certainly not an outlier. As a physician who's building his practice and taking in new patients, I've been seeing over the last several years a lot of patients who I always start with new patients and say, where were you getting care before? And sometimes they're moving from out of state or their doctor retired. But in many cases, they'll say, I just got insurance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure several years ago, but I haven't had any insurance, so I haven't been able to get any of those medications. And I've seen people with their diabetes and their sugars are out of control, and with their heart disease and their blood pressures are out of control, or diagnosed but untreated chronic illnesses like depression or hypertension, high cholesterol, and been able to, since they're covered, either through the expanded roles of Medicaid or that their coverage is facilitated by the subsidies, or just because the exchanges have made individual insurance more attainable, because they're covered, we've been able to see them, get them back into the primary care system, get those chronic illnesses under control, get them feeling better, living longer, more productive. And my biggest fear is that they're going to first repeal it and then try to come up with or pass some replacement. And in the meantime, these people are going to be without care, and that they're going to go back to trying to get their primary care needs met in the emergency room system, which doesn't work. I mean, emergency room is great if you're having a heart attack, but it's terrible if you're trying to prevent one that you're on track to have within the next 6 months. So I worry for those patients, but also my patients that have healthcare through their employers, which is most of my patients, the Affordable Care Act didn't just expand how many people had insurance, but it also put important reforms in place dictating what insurance can and cannot do. So in the bad old days before the Affordable Care Act, there was many plans had lifetime limits on payouts. Mm-hmm. And you could buy a plan and pay the premiums, and in the fine print it would say, and if your healthcare expenditures go over $1 million or $5 million in your lifetime, that's as much as we're on the hook for, and then it's on you. And you know, I've heard of cases where a healthy couple has a kid and they have a congenital heart defect or hemophilia or some unexpected but chronic and expensive condition, and when the kid turns 9, the insurance comes by and says, oh, it's been $1 million, so
you've reached the limit.
We're done. And this is also back when pre-existing conditions were a reasonable basis for exclusion. So the insurance that they've been paying into is not going to cover that kid. Nobody's going to cover that kid. And if he had $1 million of expenses in the first 9 years, how are the parents going to pay the million over the next 9? It's just untenable.
We've seen families hold fundraisers just once
yes.
they hit the cap. And,
yes.
And sort of, you know, we could be entering a Kickstarter age just if we go back to a cap.
Exactly. There were a lot of really predatory practices that insurance companies used to be able to engage in to deny coverage, to cancel coverage. So someone could fill out an application, get insurance, pay premiums for years, and then get a new diagnosis like, say, diabetes, and then insulin-dependent diabetes, and so now their expenses are higher. And then somebody at the insurance office goes back and looks at their application and says, this was not filled out correctly. Mm-hmm. So you're done. You're off. Mm-hmm. No one had any problem with it while they were paying their premiums. And I've been in the room with patients who are getting new diagnosis of diabetes or hepatitis C, and it's a very tough moment. But it should not be one where they're saying, oh, God, I'm going to lose my health care and maybe my house. They should only have to worry about losing their health and well-being, not also their financial solvency.
All right, so listeners, as the phone starts to ring, we're going to spend a lot of the second half hour on your phone call, so hang in there for a moment. But I want to turn back to my colleague Karen Chakurji for a couple of points here. First of mm-hmm. all, you heard Dr. O'Connor say that his most immediate concern is that we're going to see the repeal without a replace ready to go, mm-hmm. and that leaves people in kind of a gray area, with the caveat that nobody really knows that right. could be possible.
Right.
You've been talking to a lot of people in the system who do expect at least a little bit of a buffer on this.
A little bit of a buffer.
That no one's going to be losing their insurance in February or March.
Right. I think that especially with, you know, open enrollment really just kind of wrapping up now, it's one of these things that it's, you know, it's been on people's minds. You know, should people have asked me, do you think this means that I shouldn't sign up for insurance like now? You know, a lot of people have been asking themselves and others that question. And I think that the general consensus by the experts, you know, is that we don't have to worry about, you know, us, you know, people losing insurance right now, you know, come tomorrow, you know, first day in office. I don't think we need to worry about that as much as what's going to happen in the ideally, you know, at least year
sure.
to come is the general consensus that I've been hearing. Yeah.
Okay. And listeners, if you don't already follow Karen Chakurji and various platforms, you should do that, because her health reporting has already helped us understand a little bit of what may be in play going forward, not the least of which was a story entitled In New York, State Laws May Protect Some Components of Obamacare from Possible Repeal. So what are the possible components that may be insulated in this state?
So I think that one thing that is really important to recognize is that, you know, the Affordable Care Act is really like many different Affordable Care Acts when you look at what's actually kind of playing out on the ground. These are state-specific regulations that are kind of being carried out on the ground. So New York State had quite a few things already going on before the ACA came around. A lot of that had to do with protections for pre-existing conditions, some for kind of protections for reproductive health and access to different services. So there were a few different things that were already on the ground. Another one, I think, was about young adults being able to stay on their parents' health insurance until a certain age, which is something that was a lot of people associate with the ACA, but New York State had those things already going on beforehand.
And so it's possible that we'll see again. There's a lot of possibilities, but it's possible that at least some of those more popular aspects of the ACA within New York State could stay, if
mm-hmm.
not nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to get Karen's and frankly the whole panel to respond to an exchange we heard yesterday between Senator Bernie Sanders and Dr. Tom Price, who's likely to be the next Health and Human Services Secretary, who has been a longtime opponent in the Congress of the Affordable Care Act. I want to start with Karen, and before we listen to this exchange, Karen, you said in the conversations you've had with people in the medical community
mm-hmm.
that it's important to point out that different phrases may sound like they mean the same things, but they have different meanings. And an example is about 5 days ago, Donald Trump said, you know, we're going to cover everybody and
right.
costs are going to be lower. Then
right.
Mike Pence comes back and says, well, we're going to make sure everyone has access.
Right.
And there may be some differences in cover everybody or the term universal health care versus access for everyone, which doesn't always mean the same thing. Right?
Right. I mean, access to something is not the same thing as coverage. It's just not, technically speaking, is just not the same thing. So I think that, you know, this is already a very complex topic for people who are well-versed in the topic. It's we're talking about different funding streams, we're talking about business, we're talking about industry. It's not straightforward, even for people who are already well-versed in this. So, you know, if you're going to be throwing around different words or hearing different words, I think it's important to stop and say, what does this actually mean? What is the definition of this word?
Okay. And so, let's, in that spirit, let's listen to this exchange that Senator Bernie Sanders had while questioning during the hearings for Dr. Price. And you're going to hear some of that question on particular words there. Let's listen.
Should people, because they are Americans, be able to go to the doctor when they need to, be able to go into a hospital because they are Americans?
Yes, we're a compassionate society.
No, we are not a compassionate society. In terms of our relationship to poor and working people, our record is worse than virtually any other country on earth. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any other major country on earth. And half of our senior older workers have nothing set aside for retirement. So I don't think compared to other countries, we are particularly compassionate. But my question is, in Canada, in other countries, all people have the right to get health care. Do you believe we should move in that direction?
If you want to talk about other countries' health care systems, there are consequences to the decisions that they've made, just as there are consequences to the decision that we've made. I believe, and I look forward to working with you to make certain that every single American has access to the highest quality care and coverage that is possible.
Has access to does not mean that they are guaranteed health care. I have access to buying a $10 million home. I don't have the money to do that.
And that's why we believe it's appropriate to put in place a system that gives every person the financial feasibility to be able to purchase the coverage that they want for themselves and for their family. Again, not what the government forces them to buy.
Yeah, but if they don't have any, well, that's a longer story. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders with Dr. Price. So Karen Chakurji, yep. She got him pinned down on the question. He got Price pinned down on this question of access, what it means, and Bernie mm-hmm. Sanders is saying, as you said, mm-hmm. access doesn't mean that you're going to be covered
right.
if you can't afford it. But Price's response was, we believe everyone should have the financial feasibility
right.
to get the coverage they want.
Yeah, and I think
that's a big statement.
That's a wonderful idea. It is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we lived in a world where everybody had the financial feasibility, is that the phrase that was used?
Yeah.
That's great. Is that what's going on? I mean, I don't know what the kind of next step, you know, what if he spoke for one more sentence, what would he have said? You know, kind of what's how does that actually play out on the ground? I'm not entirely sure. So it's a lovely idea, but it, you know, it hasn't happened yet. So
in
I'm
practice,
not sure.
All kinds of questions. Would you want to know, do you mean, you know, vouchers? You know, how would you go about creating feasibility for everybody?
Right. I mean, I think that in some ways, and, you know, everybody has a different opinion about this, but I think in some ways that was the overarching goal of the Affordable Care Act was to make healthcare more accessible for people who are coming from just tons of, you know, different socioeconomic, different employment, you know, statuses. So the question is, how would that actually work? What would be the system, and how would that work?
All right. So let's ask the doctors on the panel. Dr. O'Connor, you heard Dr. Price there say, everyone's going to have financial feasibility to get the coverage they want. I assume everyone wants Congress's coverage. Maybe they'll just ask for that. I don't know. But he's implying that you're going to be able to have that. What questions would you have then?
I would really want to see exactly how that's going to be accomplished. Mm-hmm. You know, I was involved in advocacy back in 2008, 2009, when President Obama was trying to get the Affordable Care Act written up and passed. And, you know, think back, when he was elected, he came in with larger majorities in both houses. He had a supermajority in the Senate. He had tremendous approval ratings and a clear mandate. And he still struggled to even get his party, let alone bipartisan support for a particular well-detailed plan. My fear is that President-elect Donald Trump and the Republicans will find that if they actually have to come up with the details, mm-hmm. they may find the divisions within their own party, and that it is much harder to do than they may be thinking. My worry is that they won't work that out until they've already removed the protections and the coverage that exists now in the Affordable Care Act. So, sure, there's room to improve. Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act has covered 32 million people. There are still some people who don't have coverage. You said at the top of the hour that it may not be possible to cover everyone for less. I would argue that it may not be politically feasible, but it is possible to cover everyone for less. Canada has done this in Medicare.
You're
going to
say single payer, aren't you?
I am. Or even a public option. I mean, there were opportunities to do more and go farther that weren't realized when Obamacare was passed, or the Affordable Care Act. I don't think that's what they have in mind.
No, I think it sounds like they're going in a totally different direction.
Yes, and I am skeptical that anything they're going to put in place instead is going to expand coverage. They have rolled out a couple of there have been some proposed replacement bills, and the Congressional Budget Office has looked at those and said, if you repealed the ACA and put in the most recently proposed plan, I think they said 32 million Americans would lose health care. I care for several of those individuals who I can project would be losing their access to seeing me and to taking the medications that I've prescribed. And I can tell you, in those cases, it is, for those individuals, going to be disastrous.
Okay. Dr. Topol, when I listened to the exchange with Senator Sanders and nominated Secretary Price there, I'm hearing a philosophical debate. And Dr. Price is not saying this, but I recall when Ron Paul was running for president, and there was a debate in 2008, and I hosted a different radio show in town on a different station that shall not be named. And I remember the conversation that people were having that day when, during the debate, the question came up on, well, what if somebody doesn't have coverage? What if somebody who can afford coverage doesn't go out and get it? Then they get a catastrophic illness. Someone in the debate audience that night with Ron Paul yelled, "Let him die." And Ron Paul is a libertarian, and this is what I appreciate about the intellectual honesty of it, said, you know, there's an argument that, you know, there are consequences here. And that commoditizes healthcare to some degree. And the question is, should we go back to that situation where we're commoditizing healthcare, and if you've bought it for yourself or if you can afford it, you could have it? Or what Bernie Sanders is saying is, should it be for everybody? Should it be a right? I didn't hear agreement philosophically between Sanders and Price that it should be a right. Did you?
No. And I think this comes to the heart of the issue with healthcare is it is a big industry. It takes up a huge proportion of our GDP. And we do have universal access or care, if you think of it that way, meaning that I could go to the hospital and go to the emergency room and they have to treat me, no matter what. Okay? So we do have universal care in this country in that regard. But is it quality care? No. And I think right now we're still stuck in this maybe intellectually dishonest place of we're not quite universal payer. We're not quite maybe making it like auto insurance, where if you think about the auto insurance industry, there's a mandate, right? And right now, if you want auto insurance, you go and you buy your own policy that you think would work for you. There are, each state has their mandated minimum coverage requirements, and you find something that you like. Where we are now, we have some folks who are in the government system. We have some folks who are getting their health care through their employer. And if you don't like your insurance through your employer, you can't talk to the insurance company. They don't care. I mean, they care, but who's paying the bills? The employer. So you're going to your HR person, who then has to lodge your complaint with the insurance company, because that's who they're pretty much are going to listen to. And so we are in this, I mean, if you're going to the intellectual debate of, is it single payer or something else, well, then I think that something else would be more like the auto insurance market, where you say, okay, we get rid of any employer-sponsored health care. You say, okay, here's your, you know, they must pay you whatever they were giving you, maybe give you that increase of the salary whenever the law passes. Mm-hmm. But then you can go buy the insurance that fits for you as long as there's minimums that are met. Are we going to go in either direction? I think politically it's probably unfeasible. But I think where we are now is, do we go back to the pre-ACA days, which I agree weren't optimal at all? I mean, you did have a lot of people buying bad coverage and not getting coverage when they needed it. And whereas now I think we're in a much better place, but is it still financially feasible in terms of, you know, we got a lot of fuzzy math going on here.
Yeah.
Where
I do want to get to the phones. I know, Dr. Connor, you want to jump back in real quick. Go ahead.
The issue of basic minimums was just raised. That's another function of the Affordable Care Act that is sometimes overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
what can be called health insurance was more clearly defined after the ACA was passed. Prior to the ACA, a person could buy health insurance. A woman could buy health insurance, get married, have a baby, or get pregnant, and then find out that maternity ward care is not covered under the plan she got. It is the most likely thing that was going to happen to her health-wise, and it just wasn't one of the things that was covered because they were allowed to leave holes in your mm-hmm. coverage. And so even though she paid premiums, she's not going to get what she needs. Now they just say, if you want to call it insurance, it has to protect against the things that people get.
Andy Groutman, before I go to the phones here, you're someone who could lose your insurance. You're concerned about that.
Absolutely.
And when you hear Dr. Price say, we want to be able to provide the financial feasibility for everybody to get the coverage you want, and then he added, and not have the government jam it down your throat, does that assuage some of your concerns?
Not really. You know, I look back at what it was before the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, there was a, I don't believe it's a perfect program, but it's better than nothing. You know, it's to the point where I don't have to wonder, you know, am I going to have to save money for something catastrophic happening, or, you know, can I use that money to, you know, fix a car or to, you know, fix a flooded basement or something like that. Having the Affordable Care Act and having subsidies allows me the cushion to really, you know, make sure that I'm going to be around for my kids because I'm getting care, but also deal with the everyday things that happen to all of us. You know, I consider myself a pretty healthy person. So I don't have to worry too much, but, you know, if I'm worried about healthcare coverage, anyone that, you know, anyone could be in a worse situation than I am. And, you know, what are they going to do?
Well, I see the phones lit up. We're going to spend the second half hour on your calls. Our panel will field the comments and questions you have. Richard emailed the program to say, Evan, could you let us know how we can read Karen Shikurji's article on how New York may keep parts of the ACA, or at least components of it, in place? That's easy, Richard. Karen and I will both jump on Twitter, and we will post it on our Twitter feeds. The title of the article, and I'll go back here, was, in New York, state laws may protect some components of Obamacare from possible repeal, and you should be following and reading Karen Shikurji's stuff on WXXI News all the time, right? Right, Karen?
Oh, yes, absolutely. All the time.
But Karen and I are both going to jump on Twitter, and we'll make sure that we post that article along with the work that she's doing. So thank you for that, Richard. Let's get our only break of the hour and come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the New York Times had a front page story on how SNAP benefits are being spent in grocery stores, and it raised some questions about whether too much of our tax dollars that go to SNAP benefits are being spent on unhealthy products, such as soft drinks. Well, it turns out we all buy a lot of soft drinks and unhealthy products. We're going to talk about the Times story, the reality of SNAP, and how to improve access to healthy food for everyone next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, working with my colleague Karen Shikurji this hour. She's a health reporter and producer for WXXI News. And by the way, Karen's been selected to be part of the NPR Kaiser Health Reporting Collaboration, which is a great honor and a great choice by them. She's going to have a chance to do in-depth reporting on this subject throughout the year, so we look forward to that. Mm-hmm. Doctors David Topa and Brendan O'Connor are here, and Andrew Groutman is here as well. He is one of many New Yorkers, one of many Americans who are simply wondering, after getting covered through the ACA, what happens next? And we're going to start with Judy in Honeyway Falls on the phone. Go ahead, Judy.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for hosting this discussion.
Sure.
I'm one of those people who is terrified about the repeal of the ACA. I had a prior existing condition. I had breast cancer. Then my job was eliminated. And I was told at that point, because of my previously existing condition, that I was absolutely uninsurable, with the exception of prescription coverage. The Affordable Care Act has saved me because I had a second episode of genetically disposed breast cancer, and I would have been destitute, would have been wiped out if I hadn't had the Affordable Care Act.
When you hear that you're uninsurable, I mean, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who's being told that. What is that like?
Well, I realized that whatever money I had at that point in my savings was pretty much all I was going to be able to use for whatever health care I had in the future. It was looking very bleak. and I'm 5 years away from being able to get Medicare. So it would be another 5 years of I'm not sure how I would fund my continuing care.
But Judy, the president-elect has said that sit tight and what's coming next is going to be better. I mean, do you have any hope that that's true?
No, I really fear that what your guests have talked about will be the case, that they will repeal ACA and have either nothing at all to replace it or something that doesn't fill the greatest holes that the ACA did. I'm very concerned about that.
Karen, these are the kind of stories you encounter in your reporting all the time. What would you ask her?
I mean, the truth is that this is an especially sensitive subject when you're talking about access to care, and you know, you're not the only person who has to wonder, you know, what am I going to spend my money on? Is it going to be? I mean, you know, once today I've read looked at, you know, 6% of people who are diagnosed with cancer end up filing for bankruptcy. You know, it's a very real, sensitive, difficult issue. And unfortunately, we don't yet have a concrete plan to unpack. We just don't yet. And so I think that's part of the really uncomfortable feelings right now is just, you know, we don't know what's next. And that's really hard.
Yeah. I mean, I reassure my wife, and she's in the same situation of being, quote, uninsurable. And I just say, I think New York State will be okay. But then at the same point, a lot of times with COBRA, some of these laws require that you have continuous care. So if you miss a payment on your insurance and you let lapse for 30 days, well, then you're really in trouble. So,
Judy, I don't know what else to say other than good luck to you. And here's hoping, as the president himself, the outgoing president, has said, everyone will be happy if the president-elect is right, if the next system does cover more for lower costs and that people are taken care of. That will be great, and we should all be open-minded to that and celebrate it if it comes. And I hope it happens for you, though I wish there was something better any of our panelists could tell you.
Yeah, hope is all we've got right now.
Thank you, Judy. Good luck to you. Back to the phones, and Jane next in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi, Evan. Thanks very much for your show. I've been managing medical practices, private medical practices, for almost 30 years in Rochester, and I think one of the things people need to understand about the Affordable Care Act was that they got the funding. They got the funding to provide for the Medicaid expansion by taking charity care money back from hospitals. It used to be that hospitals that had resident programs, teaching residents, would get funding to cover the charity care that hospitals provided. They withheld that money and used it, funneled it into the Medicaid expansions, that 31 states took the Medicaid expansions, but 19 states with Republican governors did not take Medicaid expansions. So if they repeal the Affordable Care Act, are they going to replace that charity care money? I doubt it. So people still expect that they can go to a hospital and get emergency care whether they've got insurance or not. So, that's why hospitals in some of the southern states are closing, because they don't have access to that charity care funding anymore. And if you ask a lot of people what kind of insurance they want, they don't want anything. You know, they don't want to pay anything because they don't think they're going to get sick. But they still expect, if they go to a hospital, that the doors will be open to them. And the second thing I want to make a second point is, for people who work at low-paying jobs, you know, people working close to minimum wage, and you know, folks that work in my office that are, you know, making $20,000-$30,000 a year, paying, you know, getting insurance through the office, but it's a high deductible plan, and then they see Medicaid patients who aren't paying anything, who get better benefits than they do. Mm-hmm. And they aren't contributing anything. They don't have any out-of-pocket expense. They don't have any copay. It's kind of frustrating. So the low-wage earners who are seeing people who aren't working and aren't paying for that coverage getting more than they're getting is part of the anger that Trump tapped into when he accused people of getting things that they didn't deserve.
Jane, interesting points. Karen, what do you make of that?
I think that sentiment is absolutely out there. I mean, especially when you're talking about people who are making just enough money to then have to shell out, you know, a healthy, you know, significant chunk of their income on insurance because of the bracket that they've fallen into. I can understand that frustration, and I know that's a very real thing and one of the central you know, one of the central complaints that's been out there. That same report that you had referenced earlier, the Congressional Budget Office report, did point out, though, that a repeal would get the premiums to kind of skyrocket even more. So I'm just saying, yes, I hear you, but I'm not entirely sure what the answer is, because you know, repeal might put us in a place where we're looking at 20 to 25%.
No, I'm not sure Jane's
increases.
Endorsing those emotions.
Yeah.
More just sort of reflecting on the fact that they were, some feel, exploited.
Yeah.
Without a guarantee of anything better coming. And I also thought of Dr. Topa. You made the point, I think, the comparison to what if we did it the same way auto insurance is done, maybe that would be more efficient. Because when we talk about how many people, you know, Jane says, if you ask people what kind of insurance do you want, they don't want to pay. They think, I'm not going to get sick. How many people, if you gave them the choice in this country, you don't have to have auto insurance? How many people would say, great, I'm not going to get in an accident. I'm going to stop paying auto insurance tomorrow. A lot of people. And it sounds to me like if you really want to cover everybody, there has to be some sort of enforcement mechanism. Now, you can debate whether the Affordable Care Act did that efficiently. Again, whether the carrots and sticks were big enough. But apparently that debate's going out the window, right?
Right. And remember, I mean, the Affordable Care Act, that portion of it was based upon the Massachusetts experiment, where they did have a mandate for a market, basically for a marketplace. And so, you know, it was, I think, under Mitt Romney, I believe, you could correct me if I'm wrong, that actually had presented the mandate as being a necessary part. And if you look at the math, you can't have people cherry picking when they want insurance, because then you can't afford to pay for everyone else. I mean, sick people are very expensive to take care of, and we need healthy people paying into it. And like Andy said, you just don't know when your time is up and you're going to need it.
Can I, Jane, can I ask you a question?
Not
on the line. One thing I was just curious about was when you were saying charity care and whether or not it's the same thing as uncompensated care. Does anybody know the answer to that?
It's a really complicated
equation,
I believe. So I can't remember.
I think there is a different revenue stream that helps hospitals, especially teaching hospitals, absorb some of the costs that they're not recouping from patients that aren't able to pay their medical bills.
Okay, so it's not necessarily the same thing.
And notably, though, this would not help those people who don't have insurance to, after they get out of the hospital, stay on medications and see a doctor in an office setting.
Right.
And
they'd have
and
to come
stay
back
well. They'd have to
come to the ED, to the emergency room.
Yes, with their next heart attack.
Right.
Yeah.
But for a different kind of take on this, Mike in Brighton is a doctor, Mike?
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm a physician in town. I'm on the formulary committee of a major insurer in town.
Well, go ahead, sir.
I just want to make a comment, okay? I think our problems with health care go far beyond the Trump Care Act. And the problem is that our insurance is no longer affordable, because when they passed the Affordable Care Act, everyone got what they wanted. Doctors got what they wanted. Hospitals got what they wanted. Insurers got what they wanted. What that meant was there was really no cost control on health care, and health care has skyrocketed. And we're paying enormous prices for things which you can get in Canada for probably half that price. So if we don't really address the issue of cost, the whole thing is going to be lost. I just noticed the other day that a 10-day course of tetracycline costs $400 now. 5 years ago, you could get free at Wegmans. And it's we've all heard about what happened to the EpiPen. So the cost of medicines is just out of control. And we're the only advanced country in the world. It has no accountability for cost. The cost is determined entirely by whatever the market will bear. And hence, we have treatments now that cost $100,000 for treatment for cancer. And no other part of the world will they pay that much. So if we don't address that, if we don't allow negotiating the price, then no matter what you pass legally, it's not going to be affordable. And we're going to put ourselves out of business.
All right, doctors on the panel, what do you think? Dr. O'Connor?
I would agree. I think one of the major goals of the Affordable Care Act was to control growing health care costs globally, and it has accomplished that to a degree that the Congressional Budget Office report suggested that if it was repealed, we're expected to get an additional $100 to $300 billion in deficit spending over the next 10 years. But costs are not completely contained, and other countries are at a huge advantage for cost containment because of collective bargaining between the one insurance provider, the single payer, and the pharmaceutical companies and the manufacturers of durable medical equipment. So without that bargaining power, even just allowing Medicare or Medicaid to buy the medications that those patients are receiving collectively and achieve a better price that way would be a big step in the right direction. So that is something that could be considered, but that was certainly not something that the Bush administration was leaning towards when they introduced prescription coverage to Medicare during that administration.
We have some listeners searching for Karen Chakurji's work online by her last name, and it's not always phonetic, so let me just spell Karen Chakurji's last name if you're searching for her on Twitter or on for her work that she's been doing on the subject. S-H-A-K-E-R, so Shaker, D-G-E.
That's right.
D-G-E after the end of, so Karen Chakurji is spelled that way. Another listener writes, and I'll get Karen's take on this. He says, give me one second here. He says, how about this? It seems like we're only now hearing medical professionals as a block defending the ACA. Where was this cheerleading 6 months ago? Too little, too late? You're hearing a couple of doctors in studio, and we'll see if they agree with that. But Karen, in your work in the field, there's probably some difference of opinion in terms of systems and some probably some real opposition to the ACA.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a very good question and a very good point to make. But at the same time, we're having this conversation right now, and it's not a coincidence, I mean, that we're having this conversation right now. We're having it because there's a lot of unknowns, and people are really concerned. And whatever, you know, somebody might think or whatever their experience might be with the ACA up until this point, there's no denying that we've been set on a course. Hospitals have been set on a course. Patients have been set on a course. State budgets have been set on a course that we're now in. And to think about dismantling that without knowing exactly what's going to happen is I think why people are kind of coming together and saying, you know, wait a minute, we gotta think this through a little bit more. This is what's been going on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doctors O'Connor and Topa?
I think, yeah, too little, too late. I guess that's something I can't argue against. I was actively involved with the American Medical Student Association when we were advocating for the passage of the ACA. But after it was passed, I think, at least personally, I felt like, well, it's there. It's not perfect, but it's there, and there's no energy to improve it. I really did not think that we would be looking at the Trump administration 6 months ago. I think a lot of us were surprised. I didn't think that that things were going to turn out the way they did. And so I didn't get actively involved in saying, be careful because the Affordable Care Act is something we might possibly lose. I thought it was secure, and so I think a lot of us were complacent.
And Dr. Topa, some of your colleagues probably have plenty of negative feelings about the Affordable Care Act.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you just can't look at the group of physicians and say we all are one voting block, just like women, just like minorities. I mean, we have a large variety of opinions. And so pediatricians, I think we tend to probably fly more on the liberal side of things and the community health side of things. But we definitely have colleagues who don't share our feelings as well.
Is that because you're paid the least?
Mm-hmm.
well, we choose. it's a possibility, but it's one of those things where we, as a generalist, we look at community health as being our goal as opposed to maybe just the individual and knowing that, say, if you look at Canada and you think about, okay, if I want to do knee replacements in Canada, well, then I'm not going to get paid as much, and my individual patient might suffer under that system.
No, I only asked it because I go back to Atul Gawande's piece where they actually looked at the average income on the spectrum of doctors and family care and physicians are sort of at the lower end.
Right. Still very fortunate.
And it was interesting question of why we do that, that is, but that's a different discussion. Before we go, Karen Chakurji has raised a number of other points that we couldn't even get into a lot of depth, but there are still other questions about anti-sort of discrimination efforts in through the ACA and what happens with that. Give me a quick take on that.
Yeah, I was you know, so much of this is about health insurance and coverage, absolutely. But there are a lot of other parts of the ACA that I think have come to mean things to people. You know, you were talking earlier about, you know, patient-centered care, in terms of service and quality and pay-per-visit and all that. And I think that's, it's not just a paperwork shift. It's not just a money shift. It's also a mentality shift. And so, you know, little things are big things, like women, you know, employers needing to have a place where women can breastfeed or pump that's not a bathroom stall. These are just little things that mean something. So anyway.
And it doesn't necessarily mean they're certainly on the way up, but it's an open question as to what happens with some of that.
Oh, I mean, as far as I know, yeah.
Okay. You should be following and reading and listening to Karen Chakurji's work on WXXI News. Not only do I learn so much from that, but you've got a lot of work that you're going to be doing for the NPR Kaiser Health Reporting Collaboration. Thank you for being here this hour, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Grotman, good luck to you. And like we said here, you know, maybe things turn out wonderfully for healthcare. Maybe
you
it's
know,
terrific.
You can only hope.
Maybe it's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing your story with us. Thank
Absolutely,
you for being
my
here.
Pleasure.
Dr. David Topa, pediatrician at Pittsford Pediatric Associates. Thank you. Good luck to you and your wife as well. You shared a very personal story, and thank you for being here.
She's doing well. Thank you.
And Dr. Brendan O'Connor, thank you so much for taking the time for us as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, short break. More Connections next.